The time throughout the Republic of Vietnam is now 27 minutes before 8 o'clock.
This is the American Forces Vietnam Network, where the hits just keep on coming.
American Forces Radio.
Welcome to the Gene Weed Program, the Monday edition. Bob Kingsley and for Gene Weed, get things out of the way, a little sweet soul music. This is Arthur Conley to kick it off.
Amidst the fear and horror of war in Vietnam, there was music, good music, all kinds of it, everywhere, in the hooches and the jungles.
Give me a ticket for an aeroplane. Ain't got time to take a fast train. Lonely days are gone, I'm a going home. My baby just wrote me a letter.
For the men and women far from home, it was a connection to loved ones back in the world. It had the power to ease isolation and provide a measure of comfort and sanity.
These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days, these boots are gonna walk all over you.
It also spoke volumes about the times they were a-changing.
I'm a Sam, I'm shooting my rifle like he taught me to do. I'm doing exactly what he wants me to, cause I'm a U.S. soldier fighting for the USA.
Doug Bradley was looking to become a lawyer when the draft came along, and he was sent to Vietnam as an Army Information Specialist, 1970 to 71. He has written three books on the Vietnam experience, including co-authoring with Craig Werner, We Gotta Get Out of This Place, a soundtrack of the Vietnam War.
When we went to interview folks, you know, we didn't say, you know, did you kill anybody? How bad was it? Did you lose your best friend? No, we said, what's your song? In most cases, the floodgates open, because that's what music does, the power of music.
Bradley recently talked about his soundtrack to a large group of listeners as part of the Arizona Music Fest's Lifelong Learning Program, and I had the pleasure of listening in.
And now here to present at Arizona Music Fest his talk, please welcome Doug Bradley.
Thanks, Josh. You guys hear me all right? Everything fine? Great. Thank you for coming. It's great to see so many of you. If we could, at the beginning, if my fellow vets wouldn't mind, could you either get acknowledged or stand and we can say welcome home to our fellow veterans? Come on, gentlemen. Ladies. Woo. All right. Get better? Okay, thank you. Welcome home. Lots to do. I'll talk about me, but let's get going. We gotta have some music. You know that from the first bar.
There's something happening here.
Buffalo Springfield. Sing along.
What it is ain't exactly clear.
Not you, Rick.
There's a man with a gun over there. Telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
Woo, this is going to be easy. You guys are too good. I'm going to interrupt your singing, if that's okay. Absolutely iconic song. Any film, documentary, newsreel clip, anything about the 60s, that's on the soundtrack. And it's usually accompanied by a protest or the war or all the craziness of the 1960s. Not a Vietnam song. Stephen Stills of Buffalo Springfield was out one night, probably a little high, driving by an event that was happening at a club in LA. Turned out that, you know, being the center of the music scene, there was a lot of great music coming out of L.A. I mean, a lot of great music coming across America. L.A. was one of those hot spots. Young kids were allowed to get into a club, to hear some of the great new music that was coming out. The Mamas and the Papas and John Denver and all, I mean, you know, Trini Lopez, all the good stuff that was happening out in L.A. Well, they changed the curfew laws. The kids weren't in there to drink and get drunk or to get stoned. They wanted to hear the music. But they changed the curfew laws. You know, you had to be 18 or above to get in. And so the kids were outside, causing a ruckus. They kicked the kids out of the club. You know, they're throwing stuff. There's a fire. The police are there. And Stills is driving by this and takes in the scene. And he writes For What It's Worth, the great Buffalo Springfield song. But we take that song to Vietnam with us, and it becomes a Vietnam song. I'll give you two quick examples. I taught a class at the University of Wisconsin for about 7 years based on the book. Start and end every session with a song. It's a great way to get into this. You guys, you know, you're into it. So what we drew, we wanted to bring in as many other veteran voices as we could in the class. They didn't want to just hear from me, a guy who was in the rear in 70 and 71. So we have other folks in the class come in. And this one semester, and we always ask them to start and end with a song, first person we had in the class was a woman named Linda McClanahan. Linda, there weren't a lot of women in Vietnam, 15, 20,000, most of them nurses. But Linda was in the WAC. She was enlisted. We said, Linda, what song do you want to play to start the class? She said, For What It's Worth. Oh, okay, that's a curious pick. Linda's story was 67, you know, not long after the song been out. She's on a bus, and she lives outside Berkeley, California, one of those hot spots for stuff that was going down in the 60s. So Linda's on this bus. There's somebody with a cassette player. They go by the campus. There's a big protest, a riot. Cars on fire, tear gas, bunch of kids. And somebody on the bus has got a cassette deck, and they're playing For What It's Worth. So Linda's hearing the song, looking at this scene, and she says, you know, I don't want the protesters tell me what's going on in Vietnam. I don't want the police telling me what's going on in Vietnam. I want to go see for myself. So here's Linda at that point in her life. She was going to be a nun. Now she's got a home, because if you're female in America at that time, the 60s, you had to be over 21 to get in or get the permission of your parents. So now Linda's got to go home and convince mom and dad, oh, I'm not going to the convent. I'm going to the army. I'm going to Vietnam. Well, Linda was persuasive, and she talked mom and dad into it. She ends up in Vietnam. She was there just before I was, 69 and 70. I was there 70 and 71. She was doing casualty reports, and sometimes the number and the name rang a bell and was present in her life. She was sexually assaulted in Vietnam. So Linda comes home broken, and like too many Vietnam vets, not all of us by any means, but Linda was spiraling. Self-medicated, you know, I mean, forget God. I mean, that's over. She says, I lost God in Vietnam. And she's trying to get on with her life. Eventually, she gets back to religion. She is now a Dominican nun outside of Racine, Wisconsin. She goes by the name of Sister Sarge. I kid you not. Google Sister Sarge. And what does she do? She counsels young vets and their families on making the transition from Iraq, Afghanistan, you know, active duty, back to being a civilian. And Linda calls PTSD post-traumatic spiritual disorder. So that's Linda. It's like, and you wouldn't believe, because, you know, most college now, there's more women than there are men. So it's great to get a female vet in front of a lot of our women students, and they were just blown away, and her story was great. A couple weeks later, we have a Marine, gung-ho guy, not gung-ho anymore, but he was at the time, named Bill Earhart. Any of you saw the Ken Burns series, he's in there. And he was up by the DMZ. The Marines did a lot of the heavy-duty fighting. He was there in 67, 68, very, very difficult times. And he wanted to extend to get the time dropped from the rest of his service obligation to get out earlier. So does his 12 months, you know, he's in a hellacious situation, comes back home, and he's driving around with a friend in a car. And what Bill tells us, which we asked him, he said, what's your song to start the class? He says, For What It's Worth. Well, that's interesting. Linda was just here a couple weeks ago. That was her song. Bill's story, after he gets home and he's got a 30-day leave, he's got to go back to Vietnam, riding around with the buddy in the car. Song comes on the radio. They got a couple girls in the car they're trying to impress. And he hears it, and he says, I'm the man with the gun over there. That line. I'm the man with the gun. So here we have two Vietnam vets, different experiences, different people, same song, different takeaways. That is the power of music. You guys all have, you have an association probably with, for what it's worth, the way you were singing, but you have your own soundtrack, and that's what we found, because shame on us, we didn't welcome a lot of these people back home. When we went to interview folks, and this is, you know, maybe 40, 45 years after their service, they still haven't talked about it. You know, we didn't say, you know, did you kill anybody? How bad was it? Did you lose your best friend? No. We said, what's your song? Wow. I mean, in most cases, the floodgates open, because that's what music does, the power of music. Here's a couple examples. This one's a little harder to sing along to. Sergeant Barry Sadler.
Fighting soldiers from the sky. Fearless men who jump and die. Men who mean just what they say. The brave men of the Green Beret.
Sergeant Barry Sadler, 1966, February. So think about all the amazing music in 1966. The Beatles are still topping the charts week after week. The Stones, the Animals, the Art, all the great British groups. Motown was absolutely cooking. The Supremes, the Miracles, the Temptations, Martha and the Vandellas, the Four Tops. And country was, you know, Haggard and Cash and Waylon Jennings. I mean, this was the best music around. That was Billboard's number one song of 1966. You can't dance to it. I mean, come on. But it tapped into something. We didn't know where Vietnam was in 1966. We'd only gotten there, the Gulf of Tonkin was 64. The Marines landed in March of 65. So this is early 66. Where the hell is Vietnam and what is going on? But it taps into this thing. You know, we were all sons of World War II dads. What did our dads do? They saved the world. They stopped fascism. They beat the Japanese and the Germans. So now communism is a threat for us. And so we got to do, it's pass the baton. Son, it's your turn. And so this tapped into that whole ethos of service, sacrifice, duty, country. Barry had been in Vietnam early. It was special forces. You know, they said we weren't there. We were there. We were there a long time. We were there a long time, five presidents. So, and he gets injured in Vietnam, steps on a punji stick, has a wound. He's brought back home, and he's at Fort Bragg, where they're dedicating the base to JFK. And his brother, Bobby Kennedy, was giving the speech that day. And, you know, Sadler, it hit him. It's like, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to write a song about the Green Berets' dedication and service. And it became an amazing hit. It was a movie, worst movie ever made. Don't bother. Seriously, John Wayne even has a son setting in the wrong part of the world. I kid you not. We got so many amazing stories about that song from that era. And part of it is, you know, you guys know, those of you who stood up, one branch of the service can't get puffed up over the other. You know, we all make fun of the Air Force, and we should. But you know, I mean, even other branches of the Army, you know, are saying, who do these guys think they are? And there were so many takeoffs and parodies of this song, most of which I can't repeat in public. But one of them was by helicopter pilots, screaming soldiers from the sky singing, "Hell, I don't want to die. I'm a chicken any old day. You can have my job and pay." But it was that kind of song. One of the guys we interviewed for this, a guy named Jim Kurtz, who was in ROTC. You guys remember what that was? Reserve Officer Training Corps. Paid for your education, you had your obligation. So Jim not only went to undergrad with an ROTC scholarship, he got the law school. So he gets out, he's a captain, he's ready to go. And you know, he's a gung-ho young American, and he hears Barry Sadler, and he thinks, you know, he's a kid from Wisconsin. He thinks it's like on Wisconsin. You know, we're gonna, you know, walk through the rice paddies into the end zone, you know, touchdown, you know, we won. So this is Jim's motivation. This is what we told us when we talked to him. Jim gets to Vietnam. He's an XO to, you know, a lieutenant colonel. And one of the jobs that Jim had was, you know, reporting out activities. And one day there was, you know, we had a rough day. His unit, he was in the first air cab, big red one, and they, his unit had taken some pretty heavy losses. And he was reporting them to his boss. And the lieutenant colonel says to him, you know, I don't like those numbers. And Jim said, sir, I don't either. It was a bad day for us. He says, you're not hearing me. I don't like the numbers. Made Jim change the numbers. And that was Jim Kurtz's breaking point. He just thought, if this is about who piles bodies higher and deeper, you can't win this thing. This is not a way to fight a war. And to make me change what happened. You know, we killed more of them than we said we did. We lost fewer than we really did. And that was Jim's moment. So now, even though when we interviewed him, his whole entree to it was Barry Sadler and Battle of the Green Berets. He says, I can't listen to it anymore. It's nonsense. I can't take it. Okay, now, if you want to go to the exact opposite extreme, hang on. Country Joe and the Fish. Wait a minute. Okay. Good singing again, by the way. But how does that get on the soundtrack? Well, strangely enough, it belongs there for a variety of reasons. When Craig and I went to San Francisco to interview Country Joe, and we got off the subway at the BART station, he met us. First thing he said to us was, I'm a veteran first and a hippie second. Who knew Joe McDonald was a vet? I didn't. Yeah, I just see him in that shirt at Woodstock leading a different cheer. But it was like, whoa, that is very unusual. Turns out Joe, he was in the service before Vietnam, but was very impressed upon by and the experience. Those of you know, those years you're in the military are probably the craziest years of your life, but the ones you are always going to remember. And it was that way for Joe. But he also understood the pecking order. How the military operated, how you were at the bottom, if you were, you know, if you're a guy like me, a private or, you know, a specialist 4 or 5. So Joe wrote this song intended as gallows humor. And we got it. We soldiers got it. We veterans got it. A lot of people didn't. I mean, and that was Joe's take, because if you're in a situation that is maybe the most extreme situation in your life where you're either going to break down, or you're going to go crazy, or you're going to cry, or what? Laughter is an amazing antidote and medicine. I laughed more in Vietnam at crazy stuff that I never thought I'd laugh at, but just to relieve the stress and the tension. And so that's what Joe intended. The, you know, the calliope, the kazoos, whoopee. I mean, it's got a line in that song that says, "Be the first one on your block to have your boy come home in a box." He still gets hate mail. I mean, how can you say stuff like that? But again, Joe meant this as gallows humor. Relieve the tension. And like I said, guys got it. One of the most gung-ho guys we interviewed, a guy named Bo Gritz, who's written his own book, was this gung-ho Green Beret colonel. He had his soldiers march to that. One, two, three. What are we fighting for? You know, so we got it. Most of America didn't. Some people still don't.
Well, yeah, there ain't no time. Wonder why, whoopee, we're all gonna die. Hey, na da 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 ba ba da da dee da dee 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 da ba ba do ba 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 da ba ba ba. Oh yeah.
So the beauty of this is that you can adapt this playlist and these stories to almost any setting and any time and any theme, because there's so much good music. You know, I was telling Paul before that we thought we'd start out with a top 20. You know, which we have a little excerpt in the book about that, because we all grew up on the top 20, top 40 playlist. We all listened to the same music. whether you stayed or whether you served, whether you participated or whether you protested, yeah, you listen to My Girl and, you know, let's spend the night together and wouldn't it be nice, just like I did. We all listen to the same stuff. Now, got a different meaning for those of us that are over there and coming back, but it was a shared soundtrack. But, you know, no sooner we did this, and there was a 20 that sort of got the most mentions, but, you know, it's like 2,000 songs. I mean, you know, everybody you talk to's got their own special song or group of songs. So I know it's Women's History Month, and I know Josh wants me to give a pitch for my friend Judy Collins. Well, she doesn't know she's my friend, but I'll tell you. You know, we had to be careful. Janis Joplin, you can listen to. I mean, come on, she's tearing it, you know. I mean, you know, come on, you know, take it. Take another little piece of my heart. I mean, she is kicking it. But, you know, Joan Baez, Judy Collins, Joni, you gotta be careful. That's a little girly, I'm sorry, but yeah. And, for being in the Army. But when you think of all of her great music, if you're gonna listen to something, and one of the guys in the book says he would go to bed at night with Judy Collins because he would play her music, not around his buddies, on his own little, you know, cassette deck. But this was a song that got more mentions than most, and it's not Both Sides Now, and it's not what you might think it is. It's this. I don't know if you remember this song first. Leonard Cohen.
Susan takes you down.
What a voice. I mean, come on. You got to go see her, right? I mean, she is an icon, and she still sounds that way. But somebody's wife was named Suzanne. So there comes the song. You know, there's the association. Maybe it's not about him and his wife. You know, she wasn't feeding him tea and oranges. And we were close to China. But just, you know, sometimes just that spark, that mention. Now, I'm not going to play a lot. I mean, is Josh still here? Good, he left. Because I'm not going to do a lot of folk music. Because, I mean, you guys, I mean, that could be another whole different session. Because that music was, you know, again, our music. And, you know, I had guys in my unit playing Draft Dodge or Rag. You know, I mean, why not laugh about it? Because we're there. We're stuck. We're in Vietnam. When people ask about, you know, was it really War by Edwin Starr? Was it Ohio? Was it all those iconic, you know, masters of war? Sure, they're there. But more often what spoke to the men and women who were there and who came back and who needed comfort and resolve and homecoming, it's a bunch of stuff like this. I'm going to play a little bit of each of these songs and talk about them. Here we go first. This is Bobby Bear. 1962 country hit, huge in Vietnam, and you will know why when you hear the first line.
I wanna go home. I wanna go home.
We got you, Bob.
Oh, I wanna go home. Last night I went to sleep in Detroit City. And I dreamed about those cotton fields and homes.
This song went from the south to the north.
I dreamed about my mother.
This is his family. Every soul he does. Who does he really miss?
I dreamed about that girl who's been waiting for so long. I wanna go home.
Gotta get back to that girlfriend. You know, this guy too. Before his plane crashed in my town, Madison, Wisconsin, he was going to Vietnam to entertain the troops. Otis Redding.
Watching the ships roll in, and I'll watch them roll away again. Yeah. Sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away.
congratulations. This woman is singing every lyric of every song. Just want you to know, she's got this down. Great. Cloudy. One more, and we'll talk about these. Peter, Paul, and Mary, absolutely their best song ever.
All my bags are packed, I'm ready to go. I'm standing here outside your door. I hate to wake you up to say goodbye, but the dawn is breaking, it's early morn. Taxi's waiting.
Go back. Detroit City, Bobby Bear. Obviously the lyric, you know, I want to go home. And he says it through the whole damn song. I want to go home. I want to go home. I never knew that song. I grew up in Philly, so I was more of an R&B and sort of Motown kind of guy. And I didn't know country. And that song was on the jukebox and played all the time because guys wanted to go home. But, you know, if you want to hear, you know, Sam and Dave or, you know, the Temptations, you know, you got to, and they're, you know, guys were just playing that damn song all the time. And, you know, music was a way to unite us, but sometimes, you know, you're playing I Want to Go Home six times in a row, somebody's going to throw a beer bottle at you. So, you know, something's going to happen. But again, that whole thing had tapped into it. Where are we? You know, 10,000 miles, 8,000 miles, I can't remember anymore, it was so many miles, away from home, missing the people we love. Remember, we're talking about 18, 19, 20, 22-year-olds. I was old. I was 23. I'd already graduated from college. So I was old by Army standards and Vietnam standards in those days. So these are kids that are sometimes the first time away from home. And they miss their mom and papa, but they also miss that girl they left behind. And that's what kept them alive. And so a song like that, as brutal as it got to be sometimes after many, many, many repeats, tapped into it. Similarly, Dock of the Bay, just this whole notion of I'm 2,000 miles from home, he says, because Otis was when he wrote it, he was in San Francisco and he's a kid from Georgia. But it just taps into that thing of I'm away and, you know, I'm not sure what's going on. And I, you know, 10 people telling me what to do. And, you know, I mean, how do I manage that? I comfort myself. I sing. I whistle. He whistles at the end of that song. But it's like that's what music can do for you. Man, in a place where you need a little bit of comfort and just a little bit of solace, it could happen. And then My Girl. You know, yeah, we talk about Suzanne as I did, you know, with that mention. But, you know, we were mostly guys, you know, predominantly. And man, I mean, if, you know, you had somebody that was waiting for you, you know, that was was writing you letters, you know, was caring and, you know, maybe was going to meet you in R&R if you were lucky enough like I was. To meet my girlfriend in Hawaii. Don't tell my wife. Because she wasn't my wife then. It's just, you know, so, but, you know, it's just, you know, My Girl. And of course, and then it makes you think back, you're in high school again. You know, I was a senior in high school in that song. So My Girl comes on, I'm back in high school. I'm not in Vietnam. I'm in high school. And that song just did it for us. So those kept coming up. And then, of course, Leaving on a Jet Plane. I mean, you know, what can you say? I mean, it's all there. You know, lyrically, I mean, and just the harmony. You know, Mary Travers, my God, I was in love with her. Absolutely great song. John Denver wrote that. But you know what? If you're me at the time, and I'm leaving on a jet plane, the early guys that went over on boats, you know, took a long time, 30 days or more. Guys like me flew over. I was there in 70 and 71. I'm in the rear. I'm an Army journalist. I got lucky because I got drafted. They could have made me a grunt. I couldn't be here talking to you guys. I got, again, talk to Vietnam vets. They'll talk about it. Luck, fate, good fortune, the roll of the dice, whatever it is. That's why I'm here. You know, I'm lucky that way. But I was the guy who was leaving on the jet plane and saying goodbye to my girlfriend. And you know, I saw the song from that point of view. I don't know if I'll be back again. Women gave us the strength to get home. If it wasn't for the women in our lives, a lot of us wouldn't have made it back. And it took stupid old me till 20 to 10 to realize that leaving on jet plane had a lot to do with that. Okay, well, like I said, we can go anywhere with this. I got to play a little of this because one of the guys we interviewed, we said, hey, what was great about, he said two words, Creedence Clearwater. Kicks it. That's what Creedence did. And Creedence could go across all groups. Hispanic, Black, Native American, Caucasian, you know. Creedence was that one group you could play on the jukebox that everybody got going. And part of that was that they got it. They knew who was doing the fighting and dying in Vietnam. And they knew it personally because John Fogerty himself and Doug Clifford, the drummer, both served. Fogerty was in the reserves. Didn't know. You didn't know then if you're going to get activated. Luckily, had some kind of hearing thing and got out for him. And Clifford was in the Coast Guard. They weren't going to send the Coast Guard to Vietnam. But they understood, because they were going to get called, they were going to get drafted anyway, so they enlisted, that it was guys like them, you know, working class kids that were doing the fighting and dying in Vietnam. They were really the first group to say, you can hate the war, but support the soldier. And you guys probably know the story. I mean, do you know who the fortunate son was that he was pointing at? Because he's no politician's son, I'm no senator's son, I'm no military son, I'm no millionaire's son. You know, it's us that's going. It was David Eisenhower, Julie Nixon's husband. Okay, now for something completely different. Feel free to dance in your seats if you want. Aretha. Queen of Soul. Jump ahead because there's a lyric in here I want you guys to hear, so let me jump ahead a little bit. Okay, here comes the lyric. So one of these mornings the chain is going to break. Up until then, I'm going to take all I can take. So remember that line. Aretha, Queen of Soul. This is a strong feminist song. She's saying, if you're leading me around and fooling around, I'm not going to be, you know, I'm not going to be your fool. That's legit. But if you're Black in America in 1967, you hear that song. Aretha's doing something that W.E.B. Du Bois called masking. That is, present one image, you know, one language, one experience to white audiences, and you're sending another message to your brothers and sisters back here. 67 in America, I mean, there is no stronger image in African American history than chains of slavery. Slavery, the bonds of slavery. This is a civil rights song. You know, Aretha's telling them, you know what, they passed the laws, they signed the bills, but we still ain't got it. So We're going to not be your fool anymore. You're going to break those chains. We're going to get what's ours. Now, go to Vietnam. And remember that line I told you. How does the Army function? How does it work? How does the Army get things done? Chain of command, right? So the generals can give you all the orders they want. If the privates down here aren't doing it, it ain't going to get done. You know, when we went and interviewed some African-American GIs, some black soldiers, veterans, for them, the pivotal moment in the Vietnam War wasn't the Tet Offensive. Black soldiers say, it was the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. That was the moment for them when the chain was going to break. If you can't save my leader at home, then what the hell am I doing over here fighting this guy? I'm not sure what the fight's about. More than one soldier we interviewed, especially post MLK's assassination in April 4th of 1968, said they were done. And remember, this is the first integrated army. Truman, you know, integrated the service, but that was 48, and it was Korea, and then it was a United Nations army. It didn't happen. Vietnam, it happened. We were fighting alongside, you know, our black brother, and they were saving our lives, and we were saving them. But it also wasn't a place where things were great. You know, as we all know. I mean, do we have a race problem in America then? Do we have one now?
No.
I mean, guys were flying Confederate flags and some of the hooches. You know, some guys were just, you know, getting angry about music that was being played, and you name it. So you're out in the field, you know, you take care of one another. It doesn't matter what color you are. We all our blood's red. You know, you save me, I'll save you. Back in the rear, it could get a little tense. The Army had to wait to get everybody prepared because they had a lot of black soldiers in the units, especially combat. Tell them that MLK, because they knew there was going to be trouble. You know, things were going to be difficult. So some of the guys heard the news from Hanoi Hannah, who was, she was basically the Vietnamese equivalent of Tokyo Rose. And I tell you, this woman got the news and got it right. And so guys started to believe it. She talked specifically a lot to black GIs. And so one of the guys heard this, and he believed what he heard when he heard it. And maybe he got another rumor from somebody else. And he said he wanted to, when he heard the news, he wanted to shoot the first white guy he saw. That's what he wanted to do. He wanted to kill a white guy because he knew it was a white guy that killed King. Luckily, none of the white guys were around. This guy was alone. So he sat down and listened to the Lady Soul album that this song's on. Listened to it twice through. And he decided, you know what? I'm going to take all I can take. The chain's going to break. Do right by me. Don't treat me like a fool. You know, lead me on. Hey, civil rights. Time has come. Our time is here. Let's break the chains. Or let's break the chain of command. Whoa. This is what music can do. And it keeps doing it. Okay, we got to go with the, I mean, if you guys don't sing this thing with gusto, you know, I mean, you don't belong here. It's the anthem, the Animals. Got a great story about this, too.
In the stereo heart of the city, where the sun refused to shine, people tell me it ain't no use in trying. My little girl, you're so young and brave, and one thing I know is true.
Coming.
We gotta get out of this place. If it's the last thing we ever do, we gotta get out of this place.
Girl, there's a better life for me and you.
You guys are good. That was some gusto. You're gonna get out of this place in a little while. But that became the Vietnam Vets national anthem because of the lyrics, because of the power of the song. Like I told you, we had defined tours, 365 days for Army, you know, 13 months for Marines. So the day I got there, if I was, you know, lucky enough, I knew the day I was gonna get out. That song had just that power and that connection. And lyrically, it lifted us. And if you were a cover band, we had great cover bands in Vietnam. You know, the music was absolutely incredible. But if you couldn't play, we got to get out of this place. We chased you out of the EM club. You know, you had to nail that. And we changed that last line to "There's a better place in the USA." Because we wanted to get back. We needed to get back.
Oh, you know it, baby. And I know it too, baby.
"We Got to Get Out of This Place" was not meant to be a war song.
No, it wasn't meant to be a Vietnam song either. And it was funny because Eric Burden, we interviewed him for the book. He was performing somewhere, I think, in North or South Carolina, around nearby, near an army base. And you know, he looked like Eric Burden. You know, I mean, the hair and, you know, and everything and the outfit. And he was near a military base, and these three soldiers came over, sort of came running over to him. And he thought, you know, these guys are going to, you know, I'm crazy hippie. They're going to let me have it. And they rushed over because they knew who he was to thank him for the song, because it helped get them through Vietnam. You know, a great artist, a great group, and a song that is forever sort of going to be etched in the memory of Vietnam vets.
It was so important in all the songs that you put together. This one kind of rose to the top. Why is that?
I think it's both the message and the lyric. You know, we got to get out of this place if it's the last thing we ever do. Many of the guys we've interviewed and we've talked to, you know, thousands by now with presentations and everything else. One guy we asked who was in a combat unit right after My Lai up in the same part of Vietnam, we said, asked him about if he was pro-war, anti-war. He says, by the time we left, we were all opposed to the war. So I think even for guys that went in thinking there was some duty, some upside to the mission, by the time they left, they didn't see it.
Tell me about you. You were in college, you graduated, you had a deferment, then you went to law school, and Lyndon Johnson, and I'd forgotten this, stripped away deferments for graduate school.
Correct. You could keep your 2S student deferment beyond college if you went to grad school. Up until 1968, what people forget when Johnson made the speech that night when he said he wasn't going to run for president, re-election, he also canceled all deferments except for doctors and dentists. So there I was still a junior in college. I graduated in 69, but I knew now that even if I got into law school, it wasn't going to save me. So I spent that summer, as I think a lot of people did, and that was, Let's Make a Deal with Monty Hall. What was behind door number one was jail. Door number two was Canada. Door number three was the draft. I picked the draft because I figured I'd roll the dice and maybe get lucky, and I did.
And you got lucky in what respect?
Well, I got lucky in respect that Nixon, remember, had a secret plan to win the war, and he won the election in 68, took over the presidency in 69. And his Secretary of Defense was a Wisconsin guy named Mel Laird. And Mel came up with this program they called Vietnamization, which was turning the ground war over to our South Vietnamese ally, the ARVN, escalating the air war, thinking we would bring the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong to the negotiating table. And in order to show that this was going to work, we were going to leave because they would come to their senses, the other side. Nixon canceled November and December draft calls. So I graduated in May, became 1A immediately, spent this summer pondering what in the heck I was going to do. So I dropped out of law school because they were going to get me. Passed my physical in October, expecting to get drafted in November. And I'll tell you this, and I would believe it to be true, Paul, because there were still over 300,000 soldiers in Vietnam at that time, close to 400,000. Because of the way the war was being waged then, I would have been getting drafted. They'd have made me a grunt, an infantryman, because that's where they needed the bodies. The difference between then canceling November, December draft calls, starting the lottery, December 1st, 1969, we all watched TV or listened to the radio, the 366 birthdays. The day after my birthday was 366, June 8th. My birthday, June 7th, was 85. So I knew I was going, but I didn't go to March. And if we're reducing troop numbers, it saved my life because they made me an information specialist, an Army journalist. They took my skills. I was an English major in college. I wrote for the campus newspaper. I did a lot of writing in college. they aligned my skills with my military job, and it saved my life. Being in Vietnam from November 70 to 71 in the rear, you're not always safe, but the kind of job I had, the position I had, where I was, and the fact that I didn't go over in November of 69, I think made all the difference.
You're one of the lucky ones.
I am a lucky one.
But this also gave you a perch to do what you're doing now. You listened, you watched, you saw, and years later you interview fellow vets who are over there about the soundtrack of their lives. And it's so powerful. I think you wrote in the book that music provided a release from uncertainty and isolation and the horror of what a lot of people out in the hinterlands would face.
I'm absolutely right, and I think that's a really acute observation on your part that I never really thought about it in terms of I'm writing stories, I'm observing things, I'm interviewing, which is what I did as a military journalist. And when I came back, again, like a lot of people, I didn't necessarily bury it, but I didn't dwell on it. I didn't think about it. And of course, thinking the kind of position that I had, I wasn't in kill or be killed situations. I had a mild case of PTSD. You know, you're always on edge, you're under stress, you're nervous. I was getting in my car and driving around the country just to keep some space, you know, to try and settle myself. And then I started to write down my own thinking. It wasn't around music then. It was about what the experiences were, what I observed, you know, how crazy this was. The sweet spot became the music because I realized over time it's what kept me alive. And when I ran into Craig, who was chair of Afro-American Studies at Madison and always used music to teach about civil rights, about civil disobedience, about history. I said, you know, it presented itself. He and I just said, wow.
Was that the point when you said, I've got to put together this big picture look at music and its power, impact on Vietnam?
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. He and I were at a holiday party at a vet center because a lot of us vets had gone into his TA small section classes when he had the unit on Vietnam to talk about Vietnam. And he asked me what I thought of the songs that he played during the section of Vietnam. And I said, well, you got to realize on when you were there and where you were and what you did, it changes everything. And my soundtrack's different because of this and this. And I was mentioning a couple of songs. And we, as we're having this conversation, we were encircled by a bunch of vets who were there that day saying, well, what about
this one? What about
exactly.
that one?
Exactly. Like the guy said today, what about Paint It Black? And,
yeah.
you know, what about Riders on the Storm? And we looked at each other. We had just met. And we looked at each other and we said, something's happening here. We got together a few months after that and we decided. Now, I got to be honest with you. If I didn't know it was going to take 10 years to get this done, I might not have signed
attempted.
On.
Well, now here's something that really struck me. In 69 and 70, GIs purchased 500,000 radios, 220,000 cassette recorders, and 178,000 reel-to-reel recorders. When was the last time you saw one of those?
Isn't it amazing?
But it's just, it was so powerful.
Well, and again, it's the Army realizing as much stuff, the military, as they were doing wrong about Vietnam. They knew that they had to give us creature comforts, and they knew music was our spot. That's why Johnny Cash and James Brown and Nancy Sinatra get to Vietnam. Music was sacred for us, and it was what connected us to the rest of our generation. And it spoke to us. They knew it was the antidote for everything else that was going crazy around us. It was a way to connect us. It was a way to each other, to the people back home, give us some comfort, some solace, speak to us. And smartly, this is one of the smart things they did, they gave us ways to access it.
Music also provided a bridge between the races, but was a divider as well. And you talk about some of that.
A lot of both ends. You get this all the time. And that's why, you know, Vietnam, everybody likes to make it black and white. There was the doves and the hawks, and it was this way and that way. It was way grayer, and it was way a lot of both ends. We were all in the same situation, many of us. Could have been you instead of me. And what happened, I think, was that, you know, the music was the way that I think we were able to get beyond some of that and to manage some of it. We interviewed a number of African-American veterans who, for them, the way out of their situation, be it in the South or in the North, you know, which wasn't, you know, great that way either necessarily on race. Like I said, it was the first integrated army. We fought alongside one another. We served with one another. And they turned us on to their music. We turned them on to our music. And we have a lot of stories about that. At the same time, it could be a way that separated us, because if somebody's going to be flying a Confederate flag and playing Ernest Tubb all the time and saying the N-word, it's going to separate us. So I like to think, and of course part of it's just from my own experience and the interviews I've done, it did more to connect us and to bring us together than it did to separate us. But it did do both at times, and it depended on the situation and, you know, what calibrated an occasion. If it was Bobby Bear in Detroit City, don't play that one more time. It's really funny, because when one of the things Colin Powell was asked to do when he went back to Vietnam was to figure out what the percentage of music was going to be on the jukeboxes in the enlisted men's club. And so he decided, I think, on 60 or 65% sort of white music, you know, but not hillbilly music, 30% R&B, and then 5%, I don't know, easy listening. And one of the Hispanic guys we interviewed, Bucky, said, what about our music? Didn't get there.
That's a monkey wrench that's thrown in.
Yep.
So did Doug Bradley pick up a taste for country music that had not previously been on your radar?
I definitely did. I mean, it wasn't necessarily Bobby Bear. Charlie Pride, who some of the African-American soldiers I served with loved Charlie Pride, turned me on to him. And Johnny Cash. I mean, I knew Johnny Cash. I liked and admired Cash. I did not understand or get his music as well as I did until some of the guys from the South that I served with really plugged me into it.
So this was a learning experience.
Still is.
A painful learning experience. But
that too.
But continuing. Because when you have a crowd like you did today here, you're hearing questions from people that may open up new doors for you.
Absolutely right. And somebody coming up at the end who didn't want to share anything, who was almost in tears, saying this was painful and it was difficult, but I needed it. It happens every time. If it's a crowd of 50 or a crowd of 100 like today, or 15. We've done this in churches, on campuses, in libraries. Somebody always gets moved by the sound of the song and the story that's told. And sometimes it's their story. It's both, you know, wonderful. It's that whole thing of yin and yang. I mean, it's the greatest thing I've ever done. And the great thing is we got out of the way and let the veterans' voices come through. But sometimes it's the saddest thing I've ever done.
It's salve for the wound, though.
Yes, indeed.
Thank you for spreading that.
Thank you for
appreciate it, Doug.
Caring.
Yeah.
Great to talk.
And rock on.
You too.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying.
In 1967, a 25-year-old draftee named Frankie Gay went to Vietnam. He would later write, I was sent to a place I didn't want to be, and I saw things I didn't want to see. By letter, and when he got home, he shared many of his experiences with his older brother. And what was shared became the inspiration for Marvin Gaye's album, What's Going On.
For only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love.
We hope this episode of Honor, Thank, Inspire sparked a memory or maybe a bit of sing-along. We invite you to share it. The impact Honor Flight Chicago has on the lives of our veterans is made possible by the generosity of our donors. To support our mission, to find our veteran application, or simply for more information, please visit us at honorflightchicago.org.
Right on.